Okay, is everybody here on the conference call? Doug and Lucy? JJ? Teddy? Okay, cool. So the idea is a remake of Back to the Future, but with a black cast. And we've already got Chiwetel Ejiofor to commit as George McFly. For Marty McFly, we're looking at Bieber. No, Benny Bieber. He's Justin's cousin, but he's black. I don't know the whole story. We want to release the film on October 21st, 2015, which is the future date they go to in the original Back to the Future 2. How cool is that? Kerry Washington in the Leah Thompson role. The scientist guy will either be Fishburne or James Lipton. And we're writing a part for Northwest. Kim and Kanye's kid. Yeah, she'll be like 3 years old when we're shooting, so it's not going to be, you know, Aaron Brockovich, which, by the way, we're also remaking with Taylor Swift. No, the Raging Bull remake with the guy from Thor is totally off the table. Yeah, Jonah Hill would have been really great in the Joe Pesci role, but as my grandmother used to say, wish into one hand and into the other one and see which hand fills up faster. I love you too, but I gotta go. The interns are bringing my latte, and then my personal trainer is in for Aqua Zumba. JJ, we're still on for Thursday night at Patina. The Scottish Wood Pigeon is to die for. Meanwhile, here's a show about the never-ending story of remakes. Actually, what about a never-ending story remake with the kid from Walking Dead? You know, Coral with the state trooper hat? Somebody get Doug and Lucy back on the line. And now he put all his money into another remake of Red Dawn, but with an all-penguin cast, Colin McEnroe.
See, I think this is a good idea. It's March of the Penguins, but they're fighting communism. I think this could work, actually. The most recent remake of Red Dawn, not so successful. One of the things we're here to talk about, the only thing really we're here to talk about are remakes, because we live in this sloshing tide pool of them, and there's a bunch of them out right now. Endless Love, obviously RoboCop, and About Last Night are three sort of 80s artifacts that have made their way back to the screen. And of course, I guess last year or 2 years ago, I guess, how time flies, maybe the ultimate 80s remake, Clash of the Titans, anyway, it's all a long story. A lot to talk about here. Sam Hatch is with me in studio. He's a culture correspondent. He's the movie guy for WWH's The Culture Dogs. He's also on the Damon Scott Show on my former employers at WTIC. Culture Dogs will be doing their pre-Oscar show 8 p.m. on Sunday night, right?
Yeah, indeed.
Have a little red carpet there in the studio.
It's tiny, it's tattered, but it'll service
all
us.
Right. And joining us also, in just a second, we'll be linking up. I think I might even hear him in the background here, David Edelstein, the film critic for New York Magazine, NPR's Fresh Air, and CBS's Sunday Morning, and Linda Holmes, who's a writer at NPR's culture blog, Monkey See, and the host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. So I think maybe the gang's all here, although we'll give David a few minutes to get his can of tab open.
I'm fine. Just heard me mouth breathing, that's all.
Okay. So everybody's here. So David, I will start with you. Are we seeing, is this anything different? I mean, I just mentioned Endless Love, RoboCop, and About Last Night. Is this pretty much a typical year for just stuff being dusted off and being remade? Is anything unusual going on?
There's no real shame in remaking on its own terms. I mean, these are very cynical and, for the most part, very, very bad products in which, you know, the originals are being turned into, in many cases, hard R movies are being turned into PG-13 movies in hopes of reaching a wider audience. The tradition of doing remakes, as so many things, goes back to Shakespeare and before. Hamlet was a remake. Not only was it a story that Shakespeare borrowed, he borrowed most of them, but scholars now are pretty sure, 99%, that he wrote a pre-Hamlet, an Hamlet, a fairly typical revenge play, which he then expanded to the Hamlet that we know, arguably the greatest in the English language. He did a King Lear, which was a well-known story. And in the first one, everybody lived. And in the second one, spoiler alert, everybody dies. So there's nothing inherently. Some of our favorite movies, The Maltese Falcon, you know, were remakes in their time. Great stories. The Front Page gets remade all the time.
His girlfriend.
So I want to make a distinction here that it doesn't have to be a cynical, you know, commercially craven enterprise. What we're seeing, however, is certainly that. And in the context of so few movies coming out of the studios that aren't sequels and comic book pictures, it is very depressing.
Well, we're gonna talk about the full range of this too, and we certainly are not going to focus only on the crass and commercial remakes and the vacuous remakes. We want to talk about some of the really good ones and look at the phenomenon across history. And we're also happy to hear from you. 860-275-7266. Best remake ever, worst remake ever, whatever you want to chime in with. 860-275-7266. You may tweet at us. Tweet at us at WNPR Colin. I'm going to check in here with Linda Holmes from Monkey C, from NPR's Monkey C in the Pop Culture Happy Hour. Linda Holmes, one of the questions I do sometimes have, though, is Sam and I were talking about this before we went on the air. Why this? I mean, for example, I don't really know anybody who has a tremendous longing for endless love who, I mean, for the actual commodity itself, yes. But, but for the Brooke Shields movie, I just wasn't aware of any huge pang of nostalgia for this. I mean, do you ever wonder why something gets remade?
I very much wonder that. I certainly wondered that with Endless Love, just like you're talking about. I looked at that and I sort of thought, I get it with RoboCop. I even get it with Footloose. But I did not get it with Endless Love. And I'm as baffled as you are. There are times when it really just does seem like somebody just decided that something had enough, I don't even know what it is. Something had enough cultural significance to someone that it could be redone.
Good title,
good song. Sam, do you have a theory about that? Why redo Endless Love?
Endless Love, I think it just fell into the quick and easy scenario where there were a lot of Nicholas Sparks-esque films coming out, and somebody probably had that property on a table and thought, yeah, Endless Love, nobody cares about that, but what if we kind of rework it a tad and release it, aim it at a different audience, and, well, everybody forgot about that. Everyone remembers the song, but not the movie from the 80s.
Right, and I agree with David, too, that the big issue is not that remakes are inherently terrible. The issue is remakes in the context of comic book adaptations and sequels and everything. Mm-hmm. And then if you look at, like, for example, the top 10 box office films from last year, I believe that the only one that was an actual movie written to be a movie and it wasn't adapted from anything was Gravity, and that wasn't a sequel. So I think it's the context in which they show up that makes people so bothered by this hunger for pre-awareness, as they call it. And there's a lot about this in the producer Linda Obst's book when she talks about all the different kinds of pre-awareness that they now want your movie to have in order to make it.
Let's be fair. Her was also an original. Can I? Do you
except
mind
it was
if I
Electric
dwell?
Dreams.
Yeah, but her is not.
All right. Do you mind if I dwell just a little bit on Endless Love? Because it's a fascinating case study. I mean, it means a lot to me, not because of the horrible movie with Brooke Shields, but because it's a great novel.
It is a good novel.
By Scott Spencer, which a lot of us read at an age when we were making fools of ourselves over some person or another, both sexes, but it definitely appealed to men, probably more than women. And I think what was weird about the movie is the original movie kind of stayed true to the plot of the book. This movie didn't even come close. It took the names of the characters and it took the title. But, for example, the book opens with this kid, this really disturbed kid, setting fire to this girl's family's house because he hopes that he can save them. And by saving them, he'll become a hero. And then he'll be able to see the girl again. Now, in the movie, there's a fire, but it's because the dad accidentally knocks over a candle when he's having a fight with his daughter. And the guy comes in and he does save. And then the father saves him. And it's this warm, happy ending, what's meant to be a psychotic act. So you've taken an element and you've neutered it. You've castrated the original material. And to an extent that happened with RoboCop, though it's a much better, movie. But we've seen it again and again. Arthur. Who cares about Clash of the Titans? But we've
wait
seen,
a second
know,
now. Wait a second. No, go ahead.
No, I mean, who cares about the original? It's a they bring in the Greek gods. They're old familiar characters. They have new technology. It wasn't a good movie, but it was fun, and they weren't exactly violating Laurence Olivier, you know, who looked very pissed off to be there, earning some money for his kids after working for scale in the English theater.
Wait just a second. Are we talking right now about Clash of the Titans?
Release the Kraken!
We just have to do that.
Where's Bubo?
I feel like the Kraken on this subject, so I'm going to let somebody else talk.
Well, it's interesting because I think what you bring up about the fire in Endless Love is the most recent time that I saw a similar thing is not a remake of a movie into another movie, but an adaptation into television, which is the television adaptation of About a Boy, which has some of the same problems. And some pretty smart people are involved in making that TV show. But when they took that story, the movie About a Boy, and the novel as well, the Nick Hornby novel, they have this deep element of sadness that's a big part of what makes that story resonate. And in this TV version, all of that is gone. And so I think whether it's an adaptation or whether it's a remake for the theater, that is exactly what bothers people, is when you take a very significant piece of what makes a particular work special or interesting or meaningful to people, and you take that part out. And that part is gone, but you retain the names and kind of the skeleton, and you wind up retaining basically everything that's boring, everything that's
exactly.
A cliche.
Exactly.
And
look at
everything that gave it any flavor at all.
You're right. Look at Carrie, which is much closer to the original, and look at even something like the remake of Last House on the Left.
Yeah.
In both those cases, they end with, you know, real bloodbaths in which there's kind of no distinction between the quote-unquote good characters and the bad characters. Everybody sort of gets swept up in this tide of carnage. And the thing that, you know, many of us were destroyed by in the original Last House on the Left by Wes Craven was the fact that it sort of at the midway point, and I'm sorry about the spoiler, the daughter of this family is horribly murdered, raped and murdered, and then the parents avenge the murder. In the original, in the remake, the daughter staggers back in, you know, towards the end of the movie, and then they kill all the guys anyway. Except for the one who's sort of nice. In Carrie, part of what's horrifying about the final sequence is she kills the teacher who was nice to her. She kills kids who were innocent. She basically brings down the entire auditorium in her sort of demonic wrath at having been humiliated. And that's the thing that's like a gut punch, whereas in the sequel, she lets the good people go. She only kills the ones who were really bad to her. Now, I'm not saying that's right, that's just, but she kills the ones who were bad to her.
Right.
And she carries the teacher out of harm's way with her telekinesis, and she doesn't really bother the people, and she opens the doors, and the thing doesn't come, it isn't engulfed in flames. So what we're seeing is, the you know, it's just, oh, it's irritating. It transcends the badness of the movies themselves. It's not as television. Ironically, especially cable television, shows us unpleasant truth after unpleasant truth. Movies are going back to essentially bowdlerizing these stupid things.
Right. And I was just recently, as part of a sort of Matthew McConaughey film festival that has been going on in my house, I was rewatching the film of A Time to Kill from the John Grisham novel. And I was realizing that in the novel, the guy's dog dies, and in the movie, the guy's dog lives, and almost everything else is the same. And it's like there's this one little, oh, you can't kill the dog. You can't kill the dog.
And I think a part of this is, Sam Hatch, part of this, my son, the film analyst Joey McEnroe, has been talking about this for years, talking to David about it, I think, on more than one occasion, that there is a desire, I think, by Hollywood to take some of these things that were our movies and release them as PGs. That's been done with RoboCop, right? That there's a way to sort of maybe try to mine a different kind of audience with the same old product.
And Paul Verhoeven was strangely, just absurdly violent in a lot, you know, Total Recall and RoboCop. Were just completely over the top of the violence. So, yeah, they had no choice, really, but to tone that down.
They had a choice.
On the flip side, yeah.
Sorry, they did have a choice.
In the terms of Last House on the Left, that was the fascinating element, was that they pulled the punches on killing the daughter, but yet they felt it was definitely worthwhile to indulge in exploding human heads in microwaves and things like that.
Yeah, so, but those were the bad guys. Those were the bad guys. We liked that. Those didn't sort of challenge us in any way morally. Or in fact, Aaron Paul gets his hands stuck in a in a what do you call it, garbage disposal, and gets killed really good in about five ways, and a guy gets his head blown up in a microwave. But that's not the kind of violence that disturbs us.
Right.
That's the people who deserve it get it and get it good.
The remake of Girl with the Dragon Tattoo was interesting because David Fincher went that extra step to kill the cat. So that was one of the rare occasions when when the remake was a little nastier.
Well, he's a bastard, so he gets away with that.
He's a great bastard.
Our number 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You know, Sam, one thing that happens a lot is people, American audiences, are often watching a movie that they don't know is a remake because the original was a foreign film. This happens in virtually every genre we can think of. I mean, do you have one or two favorite examples of that either being done really, really well or really, really horribly?
The Departed being a really well Hong Kong film called Infernal Affairs that Martin Scorsese remade, which did pretty well. And that was in a period when Asian remakes were a huge trend. And in fact, one gentleman, Roy Lee, tended to buy up the rights to copious amounts of Korean and Japanese horror films. And that was a case where the remakes were being made almost immediately after the films that kind of found a footprint over in Japan, like the Grudge films and the Ring films, and then copious amounts of other kind of sub-films like Pulse and things like that.
J-horror and K-horror
and
all that.
Yeah, that was a
huge
trend.
Can I disagree with you about The Departed? I mean, I was in the minority, I guess, in not liking the movie because Infernal Affairs just made so much internal sense, and it was so, if you haven't seen it, you got to see it. It's so much better. And it's set in a Hong Kong that's in the verge of transition from under sort of British rule to Chinese rule. And everything contributes. And it's just, I think it's an amazing movie. And then the original sort of blew it in a lot of ways. But it's, I did a piece for the New York Times about 10 years ago on just this very subject, and I went through all of these things, and there kind of wasn't one that really translated well that I could find back then. Maybe there have been a few since then.
I'm not sure everybody else would rule out The Departed. I mean, The Departed is a great movie. As a matter of fact, this is a little refresher just for people who haven't watched The Departed in a while. Let's hear some.
I got this rat. Knowing, key-eating rat. And it brings up questions. You know, see, Bill, like, you're the new guy. Girlfriend. Why don't you stay in the bar that night I got your numbers? Social Security numbers?
Yeah.
Everybody's numbers.
Is this something that you just want to go ahead and ask me? Because I'll give you the answer, all right? Frank, look at me. Look at me. I'm not the rat, okay? I'm not the rat.
Start with you agree there is a rat.
You said there is one, all right? I base most of what I do on the idea that you're pretty good at what you do.
All right, I'll go back and watch Infernal Affairs, but that's a great...
Without the beeps.
Yeah, without the beeps.
I don't know. If there's one thing about The Departed that I definitely felt did not work, it's that incredibly ham-handed rat imagery. It was that was quite a refresher. That is
well, also, there was no reason for the screenwriter to decide that the gangster boss should be modeled on Whitey Bulger. I mean, it was really hilarious to me that people, when Whitey Bulger was captured, people were talking about Jack Nicholson. That was this completely gratuitous thing. He thought it was set in Boston. So he added this twist at the end that mostly ended up confusing people. And it also robbed, you know, the final, the hero's, you know, execution of the guy. It made it slightly more, less in a way gratuitous and angry and spontaneous than it was. So I mean, look, I know a lot of people like The Departed. It won an Academy Award. But to me, it's also an example. Here's my classic example of, you know, something that doesn't translate. I can't even remember the movie. There was this Pepe Le Moko, I guess it was. Was it? What's the one about the guy in Morocco?
Sam's going to know this.
The gangster in Morocco. He has this love scene in which he's talking to this girl, and he says, "You know what? You remind me of my dear Le Metro," because he wanted to say that she moved very elegantly and fast and quietly. And in the remake, he says, you know what you remind me of, my dear? The subway. And you know, that
it's
just
so
summed
romantic.
It up for me. I'll find the name of the film just so I remember it. Oh, Rafifi. It was Rafifi.
I was thinking Top Copy for a second, but yes, Rafifi.
All right. So our number, if you want to chime in, be part of the conversation, 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. As long as we're sort of talking specific films and specific remakes right now, let's pick another film where, in fact, and Scorsese is a great example with The Departed, where a prestigious director or directors took an existing property that was pretty familiar to people, much more familiar than Infernal Affairs, and remade it. I'm thinking about True Grit, which came out in 2010, and obviously most of us of a certain age remember the original, remade by the Coen brothers. And once again, just to refresh people's memory, let's hear a little bit from True Grit.
You're no bigger than a corn nubbin. What are you doing with a pistol like that?
Well, I intend to kill Tom Chaney with it.
Kill Tom Chaney?
Well, if the law fails to do so.
That piece will do the job for you if you find a high stump to rest it on and a wall to put behind you.
Nobody here knew my father, and I'm afraid nothing is going to be done about Chaney except I do it. My brother is a child, and my mother is indecisive and hobbled by grief.
I don't believe you have $50.
I have a contract with Colonel Stonehill, which he will make payment on tomorrow or the next day, once a lawyer countersigns.
Don't believe in fairy tales or sermons or stories about money, baby sister, but thanks for the cigarette.
All right, so... So, I mean, this is a movie which, in its day, I think the John Wayne, Glenn Campbell version of this was iconic. So the question would be, you know, can you successfully remake a movie like this? So, David, I'll start with you. Did the Coen brothers do something new and interesting with it?
For most of it, they didn't. They didn't really improve on the Henry Hathaway original with John Wayne and Kim Darby. But that original changed the meaning of the novel at the very end. It completely neutered it. Basically, what happens in the book that it's based on, which is a really great novel, is that this girl, when she kills the man who killed her father, the gun blows her back into this cave where she's bitten by – into this pit where she's bitten by a snake. And what happens is she's carried away. She nearly dies, but she loses her leg. And literally the action of killing this man, the revenge that she has lived for, deforms her for life. And she never marries. She never has a family, which she'd spoken of doing. She lives essentially as a hermit and becomes rather old and bitter. And this guy goes back and becomes a Rooster Cogburn, becomes kind of a drunk and wanders around. And she never sees him again, except when she comes to collect his body. So that has a profound meaning. If the Coens are really interested in vigilantism and the sort of terrible effects of revenge, whereas the original version of it, and they do that on the screen. They bring that to life, whereas the original has kind of a happy ending with John Wayne galloping around and Kim Darby all happy and everything is returned to normal. So there's an example. I don't know that the movie was an improvement, but certainly what the Coens set out to do was more interesting in many ways than what Hathaway did.
There must be some kind of Twilight Zone where, you know, the severed leg and the dead dog from the other movie and the dead daughter from the other movie, they're all sitting out there, all the things that kind of didn't make it into the remakes. Although yeah. Linda Holmes, I think it sort of it brings up a question, too, which is when you go to a movie that's a remake, you have to make, I guess, a decision about whether you're so attached to the original that that you're going to let that bother you. I mean, for me, watching True Grit, and I hadn't read the Charles Portis novel, so I didn't have that set of problems. Watching True Grit, I was sort of struck by the fact that the Coen brothers make very different choices, and they often will back away from what would be a big scene. You know, if you think about No Country for Old Men, we don't even see Josh Brolin.
Yeah,
yeah, you don't see the thing where the hero gets killed. They don't show that. And in this one, you know, the kind of the famous iconic scene where John Wayne with the reins in his teeth and the six shooters blazing, we get it, but it's a much smaller thing. It's at exactly the same scale as everything else. And I was sitting there in the theater thinking, damn, I want that really great scene I remember from my childhood. But maybe one of the things you have to think about with the remake is let go of the original template.
It's extraordinarily difficult, I think, to watch a remake of something that you very much liked and not feel primarily the things that are different in a negative way. It's unusual to watch a remake of something you like and say, oh, you know what, even though I like this, I like this other version of this better. But it's very easy to sit there and say, this is not the way it's supposed to be. That person's not supposed to be that age. That person's not supposed to have that kind of hair. And everything seems like it's not genuine. It loses a sense of genuineness for you because for you, the authentic version is the one that you know and love. So I do think if you're going to see a remake, you have to do what you can to give the new thing a chance to exist on its own. But at the same time, it's impossible not to feel things that, as we've been talking about, as we talked about with Carrie and The House on the Left and stuff like that, things that you think are significant and important to the meaning of the original that are missing. So it's a very difficult balance. And I think the easiest remakes to appreciate are always the ones where you either haven't seen the original or you're not terribly attached to the original. That's why, you know, one of the ones I like is Ocean's 11. And I think for a lot of people, Ocean's 11, the original, either they'd never seen it or it didn't mean a whole lot to them. So I think it had a much more easy time being accepted than, for example, the American version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which came up against a lot of people who, against all odds, were quite enamored of the existing versions that had already been done.
You can divide the world between Noomi and Rooney. Noomi and Rooney. Everybody is one or the other.
Colin, what you said earlier, though, now that I think about it, I sort of want to challenge it. You said, you know, why remake this thing? The problem is, you know, when they remake great films, Carrie is a masterpiece. It's a classic. It's a seminal horror film. There was no need to remake it. You know, what I don't understand is why don't there are so many crap movies? I mean, why don't they go back and look at movies that, you know, somebody blew, you know, somebody just blew it and go ahead and remake that, you know, improve on it, change the template a little bit. It's only when they sort of take the classics. Who needs a remake of Halloween? Who needs a remake of The Karate Kid? These were movies that worked, you know, pretty well. Planet of the Apes. Who needed a remake of Planet of the Apes? Now, Annie, on the other hand, which is being remade as we speak, John Huston kind of screwed up that movie.
Right.
And, you know, and to put in an African-American girl in the role of Annie will change the meaning of what we see significantly and might well be very interesting. I mean, that could be a big change. And I'm always up for a new musical. And if they want to remake musicals, I don't, you know, if it's based on a Broadway thing and it was ruined in the original, A Guys and Dolls, if it was ruined to the screen,
oh,
I wouldn't mind seeing
Marlon
it again.
Brando singing. Come on.
Well, that's true.
Don't force
Marlon
me to,
Brando singing, you know, they pieced together word by word.
Oh,
they, whatever he happened to hit a word on key, they pieced it together in the editing room.
They call you Lady Luck, but there is room for doubt.
All right, we have to take a little break here. Maybe they should remake the musical version of Carrie. Anyway, we'll take a little break here. We'll come back.
Who's this?
You know, I asked myself the same thing when my dad passed. I said, who is this man?
No, Brian. Who's this in the coffin? Because that's not my father.
Are you sure?
Look at the damn body, man. You got Jackie Chan in there.
We were very scattered today. This type of thing almost never happens.
Almost never happens?
I said that out loud.
It's not Burger King. You can't just mess up my order.
Please just calm down. I think I know where he is.
You think? If my dad's not in this coffin in 1 hour... then you have to take his place. You got it?
Don't worry. I'll get him back. I promise that. He's in one or two places. I think it's the second place.
So Sam Hatch, that's a Death at a Funeral. It's another trend that we're going to spend a little time talking about here, and that is sort of the white to black remake, right?
Sure, yeah. And the first film Frank Oz directed just a couple of years before that version came out, and that was a largely Anglophile film with Matthew McFadyen playing the same character Chris Rock was, and Peter Dinklage actually showing up in a great role in I believe he was in both versions, in fact. But yeah, so that's yet another.
Yeah,
there's a cultural kind of retranslation going on a lot of times.
So Peter Dinklage and James Mason get the awards for being in both versions of the same movie, because James Mason was in Here Comes Mr. Jordan and then Heaven Can Wait. So David Edelstein, we also with us Linda Holmes from Monkey See and NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. But David Edelstein, this is a pattern. This is a thing that's going on, is the white to black remake of movies. And, I mean, what does it mean? Why is it done again and again?
It's a huge, huge affront for the most part. You're taking properties that already exist and that you think work, and you're, oh, Lord, I don't even want to say this, but you are putting them in blackface. It began with California Split, the Neil Simon sort of omnibus movie. It was four parts, and the last one was slapstick, and they thought, hey, this is sort of crude slapstick. Let's put black actors like Richard Pryor in it and see how it works. And it ended up being incredibly insulting in the context of the film. You'll take properties like The Honeymooners and you'll cast it with African-American performers. And all you're doing is, you know, it's a naked appeal to a different audience. It's not organic. I mean, if you're going to make an African-American movie, you know, do something organic. Do something, you know, take from the culture, you know, build a story that suits these particular people at this particular time. Now, I didn't see about that last night, but I already was, if you will, prejudiced against it because it took one of my favorite David Mamet plays, Sexual Perversity in Chicago, way back when in this movie with Rob Lowe and Demi Moore. And, you know, and sort of, you know, emasculated it and eviscerated it and turned it into this sort of heartwarming love story built around this incredibly obscene and bleak David Mamet play. So, you know, I should have seen it. I should have seen this one and I still intend to. But I can't imagine how they would change it enough to justify the sheer sort of, you know, insensitivity of this way of making films.
Although,
at the same time, you don't want to discourage them from giving opportunities to African American actors and actresses who don't work nearly enough. So that is a problem too.
Although, you know, Linda Holmes, in some ways, I wonder if you can sort of see something heartening about some of these remakes, in the sense that they're essentially saying that there's a black middle class that has gelled enough, that's as discernible enough, and a black middle class audience that is all of those things, so that they want and feel entitled to and might support, say, a black version of The Bishop's Wife, which turned into The Preacher's Wife. I mean, The Bishop's Wife is about as white a movie as you can imagine. David Niven, Loretta Young, and Cary Grant. But maybe there's something good about that, about sort of the idea that, right, okay, let's make it for a different audience with a different set of values.
Well, yeah, I mean, the same way that we said that remakes in general cannot be considered outside the context of all of the kind of generalized hostility to things that are entirely new, I don't think you can look at the idea of making a movie like About Last Night with a black cast without looking at that in the context of the very limited number of films that are being made for black, with black audiences in mind and starring black actors and with black filmmakers. So I think, yeah, you know, on the one hand, you can say, look, if you're going to make a remake of About Last Night, and heaven knows if you can make a remake of Endless Love, you can make one of About Last Night, then, you know, I don't know that there's anything any more wrong about deciding you're going to put a black cast in it than a white cast in it. It's just a question of how
cynical. Did any of us?
None of us.
Did any of us see it?
That's a
problem already.
Yeah, no.
It's a question of how cynical you think that is. And all of these things are cynical. That's the thing. Like, all of these things are just trying to, you know, with the minimal effort necessary, appeal to a new audience. The cynical ones, I'm saying, not every remake. But that's very common, and it goes far beyond taking a movie that had a white cast and giving it, you know, redoing it with a black cast. You know, they did a, Lifetime did a version of Steel Magnolias with a black cast, and Queen Latifah was in it, and a bunch of other people. I don't know that there's anything wrong with doing that. The problem really is, just like it is with other cynical remakes, why are you doing this instead of making space for things that are new and interesting and original? So in a way, all these things come back over and over and again to this idea of, if it were easier to get new, good, interesting stuff, we wouldn't be so easily frustrated by stuff that feels like retreads, by stuff with pre-awareness.
Well, Sam, you really liked the black version of Death at a Funeral, and I can see the value of turning a set of African-American comedians with very different styles and rhythms loose on a piece of British comedy.
Yeah, but on the same hand, David's correct. It's a kind of micro-focused version of the cultural translation. A lot of the films that were remade in the 80s were either French comedies, obviously us Americans would not get the French original or sit through the subtitles. But then you have the problem of, well, we have this white film and a black audience isn't going to understand that. So now we have to retranslate it for a black audience. So yeah, it is a little it makes you twitchy to contemplate it. But then on the other hand, sometimes it works. And in that case, I thought they pulled it off. Yeah.
Let me grab
a
caller.
If you're going to remake it anyway, I guess, then if you're going to translate it anyway, then you might as well put in an African-American cast as long as you don't have them saying the same lines, as long as you try to make it a little more organic. That's fine.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Kathleen in Milford. Hi, Kathleen. You still there?
Yes, still here.
What's on your mind?
Well, 2 points. One, the funny thing is you've been using this release the Kraken business. That wasn't even depicted right in the movie. It's just depicted as a giant octopus.
Yeah.
And, oh, and on the website, I'm going to be fussy NPR listener. It's K-R-A-K-E-N.
Yeah. Oh, really? We spelled it wrong?
Yeah.
So,
anyway.
Release the Kraken!
Oh, yeah. We actually just threw an intern to the Kraken.
Another one's gone.
Yeah. But the more amusing thing is there's The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which they've done a remake from the original movie, which was made in the late 1940s. Mm-hmm. And it was this great movie, which was an adaptation of a story, and there were changes between the story and the movie, not that many, but between the first movie and the second movie, as far as I can tell from the ads, it's completely different from the entire plot of the movie. The original Mitty story was this little nebbishy guy who lived this wonderful, imaginative life that was not his regular life.
Yeah, no, this is a great point. And David, first of all, have you seen this movie, the Ben Stiller?
Oh, I did see this movie, and she's absolutely right. She didn't need to. It completely distorts the meaning not of the Danny Kaye film that was enjoyable, but of the original story to the point where you're going, wait a minute, did he just misunderstand this, or did he just decide he was going to make a tribute, Ben Stiller, to his own potency and spiritual reawakening? I mean, it was an excruciating film, although it looked gorgeous, I have to say. Anytime you bring your cameras to Iceland, you can't go too wrong. But
sometimes they just keep the title almost, it seems.
And yeah, it's essentially rewritten, and it's an entire property altogether. Speaking of the films that never get the source material right, I Am Legend, the Matheson story, has been turned into films numerous times, including
three times.
The Omega Man and Last Man on Earth. But it was remade recently again with Will Smith, and you thought, oh, maybe here's a chance to get it right. And they even retained the title, I Am Legend. And the entire point of that is that there's this kind of zombie vampire virus that's taken over the Earth, but they are actually the new breed of humanity. And the hero of the film ultimately is not a hero, and he's the one inducing nightmares and running around killing this new breed of humanity. So he is the boogeyman to these people, and nobody's ever had the urge to pull that off. I was hoping they were going to do it in the Will Smith version, but sadly, no.
You're not going to get that in the Will Smith
I think
version.
I saw almost
Sorry.
All of those movies and had no idea that they were connected to one another or that they were based on one piece of source material.
Sorry, Charlie. It's just it's Hollywood. It's Hollywood, Jake.
It's Hollywood, Jake. All right, let's take a little break. We'll come back for our final segment after this.
The moon is, who cares what picture you see? When you're hugging with your baby, let's throw in a bag.
Doug, Lucy, I have another idea. If Endless Love is a hit, we reshoot the other Brooke Shields classic, Blue Lagoon, but with Elle Fanning and Jaden Smith. Thank you. Yes, I am a genius. I'm pretty sure there's no plot, so that's a corner we can cut. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Anna Novak and Tess Aronson. Our executive producer is Katie Tolarski. The part of Bill Curry was played by Liam Neeson. for show pages, articles, and videos of the Faith Middleton Show staff yelling, "Release the Kraken!" Visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow, our salute to broccoli. And now, back to Colin.
All right, we are back, and with us are Linda Holmes, writer for NPR's culture blog Monkey See and host of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, Sam Hatch, who's the culture correspondent and movie guy for WWH's Culture Dogs, which will be on at 8 p.m. on Sunday night as you warm up for the Oscars. David Edelstein is the film critic for New York Magazine and for NPR's Fresh Air and for CBS Sunday Morning, which is the only place.
And Colin, I'm live blogging the Oscars.
You're live blogging the Oscars?
New York Magazine / Vulture site. So.
I was also going to say CBS Sunday Morning, the only place where you can see David Edelstein's new beard and the only media place where you can see the new beard.
Yeah, you can friend me on Facebook and maybe I'll take pity on you. I don't know.
So
Can I say something just very, very quickly about RoboCop, because we've kind of brushed that aside. The director of the remake is Jose Padilla, a Brazilian director who made one of my favorite documentaries of all time called Bus 174, an incredibly incendiary movie about a disturbed young man who hijacks a bus, and the relationship between him and the police and the larger government entity. It's a tragedy. He tries to do something. RoboCop is almost entirely rewritten. I mean, he does not simply hit the same beats that the very cynical Paul Verhoeven hits. It actually tries to be a kind of hopeful, humanist, optimistic story about the power of human emotion and the human spirit to sort of come through not only this iron shell in which he's been encased, but also, you know, attempts to cut certain pathways in his brain to make him a more efficient robot. It's an entirely different entity. I think it has a fraction of the power that the Paul Verhoeven one does. It just, you know, it just does not work as well. But let's at least acknowledge that something new was attempted, even though for the most cynical reasons, meaning the studio wants a quote-unquote franchise, maybe even a franchise that will be a quote-unquote tentpole, which is the reason for this quote-unquote reboot. And I hate this terminology, which is why I'm putting it in quotes. But anyway, let's give Jose Padilla his due.
All right, let's hear a little bit from, I believe this is from The Current, the Joel Kinnaman RoboCop.
Walter Carroll, look at me. You have two options. Option one, I shoot you with 50,000 volts, which may cause respiratory failure, organ malfunction, internal burns, and loss of bowel and bladder control. And then I arrest you. Option two, you tell me where John Biggs' drug lab is located. And then I arrest you. You have 2 seconds to decide.
Sam, first of all, do you share David's feeling that there's something worth thinking about, at least with the new RoboCop?
Yeah, and I like the case where you have an interesting either foreign director and they end up helming the remake as opposed to just your average factory director. And at least if you're going to try and change it and make it something hopeful, make it not quite as cynical, you're going to be, at least if somebody's trying to do it because they want to and not just because a guy in a suit tells them, make it PG-13. So if somebody's trying to retell the story and they actually have a reason to be telling it and reason to be making it more hopeful, then I'm game for it. I don't have to have the nasty Paul Verhoeven RoboCop. But in this case, the Verhoeven one's better.
You know, Linda Holmes, sometimes movies are about an anxiety that's of the moment. And so I haven't seen this new RoboCop. The original RoboCop really was, I think, a reaction to the privatization of a lot of different kinds of things. And so there was this future world in which certain police services were being corporatized and privatized. It turned out to be not that far in the future, not as far in the future as anybody had sort of imagined while making the movie. And you think, and of course, that was an original. But I think even of the remake of You've Got Mail, which is, of course, a little shop in the corner, but I'm not sure how many people even who watched You've Got Mail had any idea that it was based on anything. But You've Got Mail came out when people were starting to realize that little independent bookstores were going to die. I mean, maybe that's one reason to occasionally do a remake, is if you find something, some new way that the material could be meaningful.
Right, of course. I mean, I think, you know, anybody who looks at, for example, science fiction of the 50s and 60s, the science fiction of the 50s and 60s was based on a very particular set of anxieties and worries, both about sort of the state of the world and the state of science. And you know, there are ways to take those kinds of anxieties and translate them into to what the equivalent anxieties are now, whether they're the same or whether they're different. And so I think you're absolutely right that one of the things that a good remake can accomplish is taking a story, even if it is a story that people know. I mean, look at a movie like, look at a story like Godzilla. Everybody knows, everybody understands basically what Godzilla is. I have no idea what the point of the new Godzilla remake is, but I wouldn't rule out that you could have a Godzilla remake that would somehow feel current and would take a story that everybody knows and a character that is kind of iconic and use it to reflect something that's this modern. So absolutely, I think it can be very, I think it can be a perfectly valid thing to do.
All right,
Colin,
yeah, go ahead.
RoboCop actually did address that point in a kind of a limp way. It opened with this new sort of breed of robot trying to keep order in Tehran. And I think there were pretty obvious allusions to Blackwater there, to private security forces coming in and essentially doing whatever they wanted with no governmental or international oversight. It was kind of gutted. I would like to have seen the original script. That satirical point was a really good one, a really promising one, and did in fact connect with the theme of the original Verhoeven film. But I don't think it was carried through. And that's another thing that we've talked about, this kind of gutlessness. You know, even when they have hold of a good theme in these PG-13 movies that they want to have as tent poles or franchises, you know, that they end up cutting some of the material that frankly inspired the whole thing to begin with.
We've only got about 3 or 4 minutes left here, so I'm going to let everybody recommend one remake that they absolutely love. I'll go first. I really do think my absolute favorite remake is Heaven Can Wait, which, I mean, Here Comes Mr. Jordan's a fine movie, but Heaven Can Wait, there's no way I could keep it off a list of 10 great American comedies. It kind of just has everything. And once again, it has some things kind of about the moment, too, the speech that Warren Beatty makes in the boardroom about how corporations could be so much better than they are. You know, let's make our tuna dolphin safe. Wouldn't you pay an extra dime to save a fish that thinks? It kind of anticipated an entire movement that came after it. So anyway, a movie very close to my heart. Heaven Can Wait. Rent it if you haven't seen it. Sam?
I think my ultimate favorite remake would probably be John Carpenter's The Thing. I was kind of going for maybe 12 Monkeys, but yeah, I'll go with The Thing. Mostly because he was in love with the 50s version, you know, Howard Hawks production, and he was in love with that. But then he also went back to the original Joseph Campbell story, and actually was more faithful to it than the original film adaptation was. So it's kind of like a neat little best of all possibilities scenario.
All right, David Edelstein. It's hard to pick one, I know.
Damn you, Sam. I think you read over my shoulder what I had written down. I can't add to them, your points. And also what the Carpenter thing did, in addition to staying true to who goes there, the original story, is that it introduced this great makeup designer, Rob Bottin, who's kind of vanished, sadly. But the transformations that were not done in the original Hawks version are horrible and yet oddly beautiful at the same time. You can't really take their eyes off them. So I'm in complete agreement.
All right, Linda, you get to wrap it up.
Well, I am going to go with, as I mentioned earlier, the Soderbergh Ocean's 11, which is really a favorite of mine. I think that's a movie where, irrespective of what you think of the original, if you've even seen it, that's a movie where, for me, a whole bunch of people, including Soderbergh himself, as well as a large bunch of actors are all working really in it at kind of their top. It's the top use of a lot of those people. That movie is just uncut charm to me, and every time I watch it, I think this is just so much fun. This is so successful. It feels exactly the way this movie ought to feel, and I think it's hugely successful, and I love it.
All right, we've got to stop now, but I do encourage everybody to live blog or enjoy the live blogging of the Oscars with David Edelstein on the Vulture side. Sam Hatch will be doing a pre-Oscar show on Sunday night at 8 p.m. on WWH. Linda Holmes will be doing tons of Oscar coverage, I'm sure, at Monkey See and while hosting NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour. We'll be doing our pre-Oscar nose on Friday. Thanks for tuning in. Tomorrow, of course, it's all about the broccoli.
Release the Kraken!
on Kyle and Wolf. Doug and Lucy, I have one last idea. We remake Passion of the Christ. Wait for it. With Christ. I don't know whenever he gets here. What am I, Nostradamus? Oh, let's remake Nostradamus.